Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Tuesday night of Thin Air 2007. I'm so glad you can join me tonight. It's an exciting evening ahead. I would like to take a second at the very outset to ask you to turn off your cell phones. If you were here last night, you'll know that everyone dutifully turned off their cell phones except for one person who's rang, I think, two times in a row. I'm sure that was very humiliating, but, you know, it never just makes me so happy. So just take a second now, if you would. My name is Charlene Deal, and I'm the director of Thin Air. If this is your first time here, I welcome you to our evening main stage. If you're a repeat visitor, I thank you for joining us again, and I hope you will join us again and again and again and again and again. We still have a few agains left in this festival. We're just barely warmed up. I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge our sponsor for the evening, CBC. Let's just take a minute. They got kind of a cool little logo there, hey? Like a clearly here. It's a punish. Pun-ish. Sorry, not punish. Yeah, no comment. Okay, I edited that one right out. This is obviously an appropriate sponsor for this evening's show because we have the great pleasure of the company of Eleanor Wachtel, whom all of us, I suspect, in this room know as one of Canada's premier arts journalists and one of those beloved and familiar voices from Writers and Company and the Arts Tonight. She's traveling this fall with a brand new book called Random Illuminations, Conversations with Carol Shields, which seems to me to bring together two very wonderful and very potent and very powerful female voices in Canada. Our very own Carol Shields. I think we all like to think of her as our very own Carol Shields, don't you think? Yeah, we... And the presence of Carol Shields as a part of this community continues to be powerful and strong. And the advent of a sensitive and articulate and very probing and playful book that gives us a chance to hear Carol's voice again is always a very welcome moment. I'd like you to join me in welcoming Eleanor Wachtel.
Really a pleasure to be here. I don't know, can you hear me? Yes. It's a pleasure to be here, and you've managed to get me out of the Toronto heat wave. So I'm going to read a little bit from the book and also talk and also play a little bit of some interviews. A few years ago, a journalist writing a profile of Carol called me. We met and talked for about an hour, and then, although he certainly wasn't writing any kind of a muckraking piece, he lamented that he couldn't find anyone who would say anything bad about her. The article didn't get published. But I thought, there has to be something. So I thought, go to the children, you know, mommy dearest. And that's how I found out about the wooden spoon drawer. Carol, as you know, had five children. And when they were naughty, she would threaten them with the wooden spoon drawer. I'm going to the wooden spoon drawer, she'd say, and they'd run away, shrieking. Sometimes she rattled the handle. She never actually opened the drawer. And she certainly didn't brandish a spoon. One day, John, the eldest and only boy, said to his sisters, "Don't move when Mum heads for the wooden spoon drawer." So they didn't. Carol threatened again. They didn't move. They saw an anxious look cross her face, and then sensing something wrong, uneasy, they ran off shrieking. Another time when they were acting up, Carol not only threatened to phone Santa and tell him they were misbehaving and undeserving, but she actually did. There they were in tears, and it was too late. She was already on the phone talking. Of course, Carol wasn't always a mean mother. There was the time the children were late getting off to school, and so there she stood beside the stove, shaking the egg timer to make the sand go through faster so they could finish their breakfast in time. And she never told them to go out and play. She thought, that wasn't a very nice thing to say to anyone. And besides, why would you want to go out and play when you could stay in your room and read? And the children didn't have to clean up their toys because Carol thought that would spoil the fun of playing. As a writer and broadcaster, I've interviewed literally hundreds of writers over the years. And so I thought I would start by talking about how I came to choose Carol Shields as a subject for a book. Random Illuminations is my fourth selection of interviews. There was Writers and Company, More Writers and Company, and Original Minds. But this book is my most personal. Carol was a very fine writer and a remarkable human being, a wonderful person whose work I've been following closely for more than 20 years. I interviewed her frequently over the years with virtually every work she produced, novel, radio drama, play, book of stories. So I had a good sense of the span of her work and also her evolution as a stylist. But the key reason I wanted to make a book focusing on her life and work is that we were friends. And that offered not only a whole other side to the relationship, but it also meant that I was deeply affected by her illness and death. And in a sense, I wanted to bring together everything that I had, those conversations that had been recorded, some of her letters, my recollections, journalism, speeches, and so on, and to pay tribute to, and moreover, to evoke, a very special person. This book is not an elegy. It is, as Carol was so attuned to, about the shape, the arc of a life. I first met Carol Shields in 1980 in Vancouver at the Literary Storefront in Gastown, and had already reviewed her second novel, The Box Garden, for the Vancouver Sun. I remember liking her and liking her work. I subsequently reviewed a lot of her books. But unfortunately, we didn't get to know each other then, and that was the only time that we lived in the same city. But in the fall of 1987, I newly moved to Toronto and started working full-time for CBC Radio, and Carol published Swan, a Mystery. And I love this book, and I was gratified when 10 years later Carol said that it was her favorite. I did a short radio piece about the novel, and then I decided to put together a special issue on Carol for a feminist literary magazine I'd been associated with in Vancouver. It ended up being a double issue, and I went on to use some of the material for a cover story about Carol for Books in Canada. But this was my first real conversation with her, and it was a great luxury because it was spread out over 2 days on two different occasions, and it covered everything from birth and growing up in Oak Park, Illinois, to her latest novel. And on the subject of birth, I remember later when discussing the Stone Diaries and its unusual births, Carol said, in the case of my own birth, my mother used to talk about it and it used to embarrass me terribly. She would say, "Oh, you just slipped out like a lump of butter." And I used to say, "Oh, mother, don't say that." But let me read you a little bit from that time. We met twice, first in my flat and then the second time for lunch. And I used the lunch as a scene setter when I wrote the cover story about Carol for Books in Canada. Carol Shields is sitting at a restaurant looking like a character from one of her early novels, what used to be called Sensibly Dressed. A soft cream-colored sweater fastened at the neck with a gold bow pin. Matching skirt, pumps, simple stud earrings, pearl ring and gold bracelet on one hand, gold wedding band and diamond engagement ring on the other. Shields is thin with short blonde hair and clear blue eyes behind thick-lensed glasses, which she removes and folds on the table. She has a small, soft, somewhat hesitant voice. She admits to a certain passivity, a reticence. And then she disarms by saying, "Okay, ask me something personal." I remember a lot of those first conversations. For instance, how Carol's learning to read at 4 was the central mystical experience of her life. "Just at that moment," she said, "you know, Helen Keller's wonderful moment when she put it all together, reading, realizing that those symbols meant something, that I could be part of, was like an act of magic. And how fond she was of Dick and Jane in the school readers. I understood Jane, she said. Jane was very sturdy and knew her own mind. And I loved the way that Dick was good to her, protective of her. Everyone was terribly good to everyone else. There were no bad intentions. And then she told me a little story about her slightly older brother and herself when they were children. When we walked in the back lane, she said, he always said the moon followed him. Did anybody see the moon tonight? It's full, I think. It's quite gorgeous. We walked in the back lane. He always said the moon followed him. And then I said, no, it always follows me. We paced off and we walked. And I suddenly saw it followed everybody. And this was sort of a revelation. Some of you may recall Carol drew on some of these vivid childhood experiences of her own for her central character, Rita Winters, in her last novel, Unless. A few days after those first conversations, she had some more thoughts and wrote me a letter. I've never for a minute doubted the value of women's experience. Whenever my books met with critical scorn because of their subject matter, I just shrugged. Other critical comments I listened to, but not this one. Excuse me. When I told you living in England made a socialist of me, I meant that was when I became active. The exact moment of enlightenment came years earlier in a high school class when a teacher explained about the division of wealth in terms of need. This was in the McCarthy era, and I was astonished that this was what all the fuss was about. Why, this sounded suspiciously like what I'd learned in Methodist Sunday school. And it sounded so sensible. Just one of those many double messages floating around in those days. I think I did recognize the doubleness, but thought it ironic and funny and couldn't get too worked up about it. It's funny that radio interviews can create instant intimacy. I mean, talking about often personal things, just the disembodied voices. But I actually very rarely become friends with people that I interview for radio. It used to happen occasionally with print when I've written profiles of writers because I had more opportunity to spend time with them, follow them around, hang out, interview their friends, and so on. And similarly, I think my friendship with Carol began when I was editing that special double issue. Not only those long conversations, but also I became a kind of commissioning editor because we discussed some stories that she contributed to the magazine and we corresponded. And from then on, we stayed in touch and would meet whenever she came to Toronto. Later, we spent a little bit of time in France. I stayed at her place in the Jura and another time in Burgundy. And I think all this laid the groundwork for a friendship that only intensified after she became ill. Initially, at least, a lot of our conversation was about books, what we were reading, what we thought of it, what we would recommend, literary gossip, and so on. I loved how her mind worked. And for someone who was unfailingly nice, well, nice is too bland a word, someone who was unfailingly kind and considerate, she could be fierce. For instance, there were two books that I was sure she would like because of the France connection. The first was Flaubert's Parrot by Julian Barnes. Carol was a big fan of Flaubert. She'd read his correspondence and so on. But she hated the book. And then in a letter, she marveled at how much Flaubert's Parrot irritated her. She said, I do seem uncommonly vexed, infuriated. And she quoted from her own diary, her disappointment with the book, because it begins with a dazzling piece of description that makes you think you're in the hands of a great storyteller, and then it's downhill from there. Because he insults and belittles and bullies the reader. Because he's aggressively cute. Because he's intellectually shallow but with high pretensions. Because more than half the book is quotations. Because the skinny little story he keeps promising is a bore. Wow, pow, she concludes, what a dose of vitriol. Was it something I ate? And the second France-related author that I was wrong about was John Berger, who lives in the Jura and had written Pig Earth and a series of books set amongst the French peasantry, all of which she found deeply patronizing. But much more common were Carol's enthusiasms, which make these other comments stand out. Carol could also be very funny. In one instance, long before she wrote her little biography of Jane Austen, she gave a talk at a Jane Austen conference in Ottawa. And Carol's interest in Austen went back to her own childhood and her search for intelligent female heroines in fiction. The focus of this talk was Emma, and she spoke about the image of the body, or rather, the lack of image of body. Her paper was subtitled, No Fingers, No Toes, because Austin never in all her books mentions these bodily bits. As Carol wrote to me at the time, no hips, no kidneys, wombs, shins, skin, intestines, navels, either. Thank heaven someone's done a concordance, so I'll be able to report accurately that in all of Austin there are 8 necks, 6 knees, 2 eyebrows, 10 ears, 1 ankle, etc. Actually, there are 6 breasts, but they all belong to men. But speaking of body parts, I asked her once if she thought she ever unconsciously revealed things about herself in her writing. And she told me about a letter she got from a dental hygienist in Northern California who wanted to write a whole column about her in their national journal because there were so many teeth in her novels. The woman proceeded to quote with page numbers all the places where Carol had mentioned teeth. And she wanted to know why. Carol said, I'd never really noticed this drift towards dental hygiene. I wrote back that teeth are a part of life. They're an important part of life. You have to maintain them, use them, and so on. But even to me, that sounded inadequate. So now I have to subject myself to severe analysis and find out what it is. In the fall and winter of 1993-94, Carol and her husband Don were on sabbatical in Berkeley. And this was also the season of the Stone Diaries, which was her overnight success, as I like to call it, because after 20 years, this book was just a breakthrough. It won the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Pulitzer Prize, the Governor General's Award. One of the first honors was being a finalist for the Booker Prize, England's most prestigious book award, ultimately won that year by Roddy Doyle for Paddy Clark, Ha Ha Ha. In one of her letters, Carol described going to London for the ceremony. And the thing about the Booker is the contenders don't know ahead of time whether or not they've won. This is from a letter. Now here follows a brief Booker Prize report, brief because it seems so far away, dreamlike, though it was only a few weeks ago. It was both dazzling and awful, extraordinarily sophisticated and curiously boorish. The Guildhall, where the awards dinner was held, is utterly beautiful, and the people, men in black tie, women sparkling with jewelry and wearing mostly black too, were also rather beautiful. I bought new earrings for the event, my only investment in beautiful peopledom. We sat at round tables for the dinner, trying to ignore the TV cameras, which seemed to be everywhere. Cigars were passed after dinner. Now that's pretty boorish. The speeches had little cynical edges on them, past grievances trotted out, not quite nice. The head of Booker Inc., an immense red-faced man, informed me that Winnipeg was a very, very dull place. And I was quite lost for a reply. Is it? I said, lamely. Our table was with Fourth Estate people, the English publishers of the Stone Diaries, and with some Guardian people, too. They're a major investment in the firm. I thought the head of Fourth Estate, Victoria Barnsley, would burst into tears when Roddy Doyle's name was called. But I have to admit, ever the pessimist, I'd expected it. By the way, Roddy Doyle and I both forgot to bring our invitations to the dinner and had to go to a little anteroom to be interviewed before they would let us in. Security at the dinner was extremely tight since Salman Rushdie was there. This is back in 93. Salman Rushdie was there looking, I might say, exactly like Salman Rushdie. Someone whispered into my ear after dinner, Mr. Rushdie would like to meet you, and then led me through what I thought was a crowd of his friends, but was in fact a crowd of bodyguards, 4 men deep. We had a nice chat about the future of the novel, and he said he was in the middle of mine. I didn't know whether to believe this or not, but decided I might as well. I also met Stephen Spender, 84, erect and handsome still, and his wife, who looks like an El Greco ghost, very old, very stately. They both told me they were rooting for me, though I think they put it more elegantly. After dinner, I met Margaret Drabble. We had a pleasant chat, very polite and friendly, though I don't think we said anything memorable to each other. All quite marvelous, so that I almost forgot that I'd lost. I also met all the other nominees briefly, including Carol Phillips, who gave me a stiff hug, and he whispered something about the tyranny of colonialism in my ear. A sort of roller coaster night, and suddenly it was over, and I was on my way back to California, and then back to Toronto, then back to California, back to normal, whatever that means. I think it means being able to formulate my own breakfast and knowing where I am when I open my eyes in the morning. Carol wasn't just a good writer, she was also a very good reader and an attentive reviewer. At the end of one review of Lucy Maud Montgomery's journals, Carol referred to the transcendent and healing possibility of art. So I asked her about what writing had meant in her own life. She said, I think a lot about this business of art and who makes it and who gets to name it and who gets to name the culture in our society and what it means to make art. And without getting too pretentious about this, I think that the ability to take the words in my head and put them on paper has again and again rescued me from what I might think of as emotional bankruptcy. The fact that I can actually still do this has given me the sense, and I always think of it as making. You know, the filmmaker Jean Renoir once described art that way. Art is making. It's a very nice definition, and it's exactly what I feel. Art isn't looking at something and appreciating. It's actually making. And I feel that this making that I've been privileged to do has given me a center to my life that I might not otherwise have. So healing, yes, in the sense that it's this place that I can go to. It's this refuge. It doesn't always work perfectly. And I know that when I have a good day, I'm going to be punished for it the next day. And there are bad days, the days when everything you put on paper doesn't match that golden book in your head. But getting as close as possible gives me a kind of pleasure which very few other things do. Now, she said this before she became ill, but I don't think that that fundamentally changed her relationship to writing. Writing continued to provide a refuge, a space she could inhabit where she wasn't sick or preoccupied with illness. I'd like you to hear just a bit from an interview I did with Carol, and this was on stage at the Authors Festival in Toronto. All the interviews are there, in fact, more than was actually broadcast from our conversations are in the book, but I thought it would be nice for you, since we're here, you could hear the sound of her voice.
Carol Shields, about a year ago, you were diagnosed with breast cancer. And it's like one of those cracks in the surface that you sometimes write about, or in this case, maybe a chasm, revealing a frightening fragility in our lives. Can you talk about it?
Well, yes, I can. It was a great surprise. I had very naively thought all these years that I was not the breast cancer type, whatever that is. And it turned out that I was. I think, first of all, there's a feeling of unreality. It took me a good month, maybe a little longer, to actually accept that, that was the reality. That was really what was going to happen. I couldn't turn it back. I couldn't dismiss what had invaded my body. But then I did accept it, because there's nothing really else to do. And then, of course, you get into touch with other people who are going through this, which is enormously helpful. And I understood for the first time why people with different diseases do form these associations, because they need so badly the experience of other people so that they don't feel alone in that sorrow that they feel. And then I suppose you think that, at least I went through this thought process of surprise at how good people were to me, how people looked after me and took over so much of what I had formerly dealt with by myself. So there was a lot of giving over, and I suppose that implies a kind of loss of self-sovereignty in a sense, but it was something that I certainly had to do for a while.
You said people encouraged you to keep a cancer journal.
Yes, everyone encouraged me to keep a cancer journal. I think they just thought, oh, well, she's a writer, she's having this experience, you know, she's the ideal person to do this.
But you say you had trouble with it.
I had a lot of trouble with it. I just didn't feel like doing it. I had no interest in it. I had to drag myself off to do sometimes just a sentence a day. But I was glad that I did in the end. Because it helped me keep track of the patterns of response that I was going through. And, of course, it was a question of these peaks and troughs of false hope and then something going wrong and then more optimism, and then the dashing of that. And, you know, you begin to see this as a kind of natural rhythm in your life, and that helps you, I think, to accept it. And also, I mean, I had trouble with it at first because for some reason, I don't know why, I was trying to make it amusing, trying to make it funny, like Irma Bombeck gets cancer. And then I just realized one day, I don't have to do this. This is a life and death illness. I don't have to make this amusing. It's for me anyway, this journal.
You've talked about being concerned about the unsettling self-absorption that cancer had led you into. How did you escape that?
Well, I don't know that I have. I mean, this was one of the things that worried me more than anything else, this self-absorption. You know, every muscle that twitches, every little pain you feel, you know, you're always sort of listening to your inner music and testing yourself against the healthy people in the world. And I worried about this, that it would make me too self-absorbed. So that, you know, because part of the joy of my life has been, reaching out and having people around. They say writers aren't sociable, but they are. They are terribly sociable beings.
And you've talked about, what, a desperate curiosity, I think you
mentioned. Yes, yeah. So I didn't want to lose that, and I worried about that. I think it's just diminishing now because I'm feeling a little stronger and I'm living in a different place this year. I'm having new experiences every day. You know, I'm getting out of this terrible introspection.
Carol and Dawn were living in England that year. I've been asked if it was difficult for me to write this book, to revisit the loss of my friend while preparing the manuscript. And the answer is yes and no. Random Illuminations is much more about life than about death. Working on the manuscript gave me numerous opportunities to revisit our conversations, correspondence, her books, and so on. And even listening to the audio tapes of interviews made her so alive to me. At the same time, there were some dark moments and harder moments, particularly from the end of our last interview.
Perhaps one of the most chilling things that your character in Mortality says is that ultimately the truth, though rarely admitted, is that there is very little that anyone can do for anyone else.
Yes, I think this is true in a certain way. People do have done a lot for me, but I think you come to a point, you know, where you have to do it yourself and construct your own place, and you have to do it alone.
How have you found the strength to do that?
Well, it's been very gradual. I've found it gradually. I found it through talking to people, to reading novels. I always come back to reading novels. A certain an awareness of how we do this part of our life by ourselves.
Do you ever think in terms of something unless something? I mean, to go back to that funny word.
Do you mean in terms of something after this life?
Whatever, anything.
No, I don't. I never think in terms of something after this life. No, I think this is it, and this is why we have to use, you know, the time we've got to blurt and blurt bravely, and. And get some words on paper and have lots of conversations with lots of people. I think that's very important, connecting and having conversations. I think that's a huge part of our lives. Big part of my life, anyway, has been that. Being interested in that's it. I've been able to remain interested in everything that's happening. And I just, you know, you want to hang on to that as long as you can.
As the character in Mortality says, she goes right up to the wall. I mean, that life goes on right up to the... It's not even a breath away.
Yes.
From
yes. I find that a very comforting thought. That it, I mean, if you think of death as a part of life, and in fact it is, it just intersects exactly with it, and it's just a breath away. Yeah, it's not that big a thing.
Knowing Carol Shields was such a gift, first through her writing and then as a friend. The whole idea of random illuminations, of moments of transcendence that cut through everyday experience in a miraculous sort of way, when some sort of pattern to the universe is glimpsed, clarity, harmony, whimsy, this fit Carol so perfectly, her openness and her enduring sense of engagement and curiosity. It could be something as simple as sharing an umbrella with a stranger in Tokyo and walking in synchronicity together. She said, I believe in these moments when we feel or sense the order of the universe beneath the daily chaos. They're like a great gift of happiness that comes unexpectedly. I think Carol was inspiring. I was conscious of that, and I continue to think about her vivid sense of life. So I decided to make this book where you can meet her and you can get to know for yourself an extraordinary person. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Eleanor. It's amazing to hear Carol's voice again, isn't it? I remember, as I suspect many people in this room do, I think many of us have a moment, a Carol moment, in this city, in this, especially in a kind of literary community in this city. I remember one time as a grad student waiting at the bus stop, and I have no idea why Carol would be taking a bus, but she stood and had a chat with me. She knew who I was as being somebody in the same department, and we had a great big talk about Swan on the bus. And I got off the bus and like, wow, Carol Shields just had a chat with me. I felt like I'd kind of been blessed in a strange way. And in my travels before reading this book, but I thought of it often when I was reading this book, Eleanor, that I think many of us who had an encounter with Carol felt somehow like we were special in that moment of encounter.
When you say she talked to you on a bus, I mean, Carol belonged to a book club. There might even be some people in this room who were with her in the book club. So, and it wasn't just to present her books. It was to meet with other women and talk about books. She stayed in touch with friends from her childhood. She stayed in touch with friends in every city that she lived in.
She had a real gift for friendship.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's related to her writing?
I think how people actually produce what they produce as writers is quite mysterious.
No kidding.
So I think we can we can speculate on connections between the life and the work, but I think where the work actually comes from is really a mystery.
She says in one of those little clips that you played, or maybe it was in a piece that you read, because her voice is so strong, it's hard to remember if you read it or if she said it, about how important conversations are.
Yes, she said that at the end, yeah.
It seems like...
To me, I feel very vindicated when she says that in publishing a book of conversations. She valued conversations. Right.
Yay! 4 books of conversations, actually.
Yeah, but this one in particular with her, yeah.
Yeah, this one has a different... This book has a different feel from your other books of conversations. And I wondered, I know you've given us an idea in your talk and in that lead essay in the book about this being a much more personal project for you, putting together this book. But it's not really a collection of interviews. What is this book?
It's not a collection of interviews. Each of my previous books has been like an anthology of interviews, each one bigger than the one before, with 20 plus interviews in each volume. And at the end of that, I decided I wanted to make a smaller book. I wasn't sure initially what. And then it was really, as I said, because of the friendship with Carol and because of how affected I was by her illness and death, that I wanted to not only pay tribute to her, but to evoke her, to evoke her life. And work, and bring together all these things that I had, and the fact that it ends up being something like a biography, if I have to quote Alice Munro.
Yes, you because, sure should.
No, I have to quote Alice Munro. I was totally tickled because Alice Munro agreed to look at the manuscript and possibly write a blurb, and I have to quote her because... Actually, maybe you should read it. I'm probably too modest to read it.
Okay.
Maybe not.
I've never been... And I've never been asked to be Alice Munro before, but I'm happy.
The back of the book.
She's at the front of the book.
No, the back of the book.
Oh, the back of the book is better. I could read them both.
No, just the back.
Okay, the back. This book isn't presented as a biography, but it seems to me to do just what the most discerning biography should do. That is, to give us a clear and lively and responsible and, yes, illuminating revelation of a writer's life and thought. You have to print that in the back of your book. Absolutely.
Yeah. No, but I didn't intend it to be a biography, but I think it does give a picture of a life and work, and almost as gratifying, equally gratifying, maybe more gratifying than Alice Munro's blurb was Don Shields' reaction to the manuscript, which was similar in the sense that he felt that this evoked the life and work. So I'm thrilled if that's what it does, if it creates a picture of a life and work without having to do the steps that are involved in creating a biography, straightforward biography.
In a way, the narrative, the biographer's necessary narrative, is implied in this book, because she offers a lot of the data about her various parts of her life that have really mattered to her. But you, as the biographer, quote unquote, don't have to kind of put the whole storyline in place. You kind of assemble the parts and let them.
I'm much happier to have other people tell their stories than have me impose a story on them. So no, this suits me too.
Yeah, it's really exciting to see her speak about how she understands her own work, which is something that you draw out of all sorts of writers. Can you talk about what makes the interviews with Carol special to you, besides the fact that you were attached to her or fond of her, or friends with her? Like, what do you think is special about these interviews with Carol?
I think there's partly the fact there's a cumulative effect too, and they really go back. I mean, the very first interview, the one that I did for this special issue of Room of One's Own, really goes right back to the beginning, right back to her childhood, and you can just see what Carol was so fond of herself, and what attracted her to biography as a reader, and even to some degree, small degree, as a writer, and a sort of pseudo biography or autobiography, as in the Stone Diaries, mm-hmm. is this arc of a life. And I think because it's a cumulative effect. It's not just one interview about a couple of books at one occasion, which is more typical of what I do with other writers, but that you. There's that very first interview that goes right back to the beginning. And then through every book that she wrote, and every play and book of short stories, you get the sense of intention, you get the reaction to what happened after Stone Diaries was such a great success. You get what she said at the time that she wrote Stone Diaries. She thought that she was feeling, it has, I think, a very dark ending. The Daisy Flett never knew love, never heard anyone say I love you, and you hear Carol's response to feeling darker. But then she comes in with Larry's Party, with a whole complete, couldn't find a more different book, about trying to tap into what it's like to be a man at this point in our society, at our time, and ends in a much happier note. And then on to the other, I mean, there's just, you could just, It's cumulative. So it's not that each individual... I mean, if I were to stand up one conversation against another conversation, I wouldn't say, like, this conversation is better than any conversation I've ever had with anyone. You know, I wouldn't say that.
Right.
But it's putting it all together. And then I included some letters just because, as you could hear, Jim, just to give a slightly different angle. It's still her, the same voice, and the voice reinforces itself. When you hear the interviews, you hear the affection in her voice there too. So I think it's, I'm very happy with the book because it puts it all together in one place.
One of the things that I noticed, which didn't surprise me from having heard Carol read and heard her talk, is that in the course of all these reading these interviews and reading the letters in a group, you can hear certain patterns that interest her, hear them kind of emerging and emerging again and emerging and slightly changing, and sometimes a same idea, like the idea about the arc of a life being that, for her, that was kind of a grail for her. Don't you think that was something that just was so compelling, how a life is shaped? And that idea came up two or three times in terms of just slightly different context around it. And so there's a way in which the interviews talk to one another, mm-hmm. not just give you more data, but kind of reframe and reinforce. And
yeah, there are a few motifs that we sort of hit on more than once. One is random illuminations, and then the dark side of that, which are these sort of cracks in the surface that reveal something very frightening or can. Another was the idea of home, that the search for a home, and sometimes that she would think of that, I mean, going right back to Odysseus, but sometimes it would be metaphoric home, sometimes it was a literal home. It was just the idea of regrets or not having them, the idea that in one way she wished she had had a job in the world, you know, a more conventional job. She's taught at the university, she was a chancellor, she wrote books, but sometimes or other she would think she was glad her daughters had jobs in addition to raising a family and doing everything else in the world. So, I mean, there are certain notes that she would touch on.
It's hard to imagine her wanting to have a job.
I know. Yeah, it was just, I say, any regrets? And you say, well, there is this regret.
I've written a ton of incredible novels, and
I've had five children. I have X, you know, whatever. Yeah, no, I know. But she was, she was very modest about what she was doing.
Yeah, she was very modest. Can you tell me what would have been the most challenging thing about putting this book together?
It's hard to say exactly. In a very nuts and bolts way, going through the interviews and making sure there wasn't a lot of repetition, because sometimes things did crop up again. I mean, the interviews are edited. It's not a straight transcript or anything like that. I think it was more just the emotion. The emotion I would feel every time I went. I mean, I went through over the manuscript so many times, and in terms of rearranging the interviews, and editing them, and then getting them copy edited, and then sending them out again. Every time I'd go over it, and every time I'd come to the end of the last interview, I would choke up, you know, and then go on to that after that. You know, I mean, I think I kept going through this sort of emotional, not roller coaster as she describes the Booker, but just there is something that happens every time I would. So I suppose in one way that just was sort of personally the hardest thing. And also, I'm not used to... I mean, to me, even just my introductory essay is much more revealing than I normally am in the world. So to me, this is, I know it's not uncommon. I mean, you know, it's perverse to not spill your guts, but I'm not the sort of person who typically does.
It's perverse to not?
Well, in our society, with all these talk shows and reality shows and everything.
Like Jerry Springer.
Everything, you know, you're in the confessional and you're abuse and, you know, all these other most unfortunate things that people have. So, but I'm not that, I'm not interested typically in doing that. So to me, even recounting that period in my life when people who were very close to me were dying is that to me is a bit hard to put out there as well.
It's interesting that would be, that you would remark on that, because I mean, I have heard a lot of people in your presence say things that they probably weren't necessarily intending to say.
Oh, I love getting them to say that. Well, you're absolutely right. No, I'm very interested in people's childhoods and families and everything, of course. But in terms of putting myself out there, that's what I mean.
Are you slightly uncomfortable being interviewed?
It's not my preferred mode of discourse.
Do you think we should ask her something? I'll try a Carol. So, can you tell me something personal?
Oh, I have. I already have.
Yeah, the introductory essay is one of the things that's very compelling about the book, and not so much because it's a very personal story, because it is a very personal story, but in a way the introductory essay sits as kind of a tunnel in to a story of a life of a person that obviously matters to many people, including you. The person that we meet, the Carol that we meet in these interviews and in the letters, is so... I was startled by her, I think, by how present and bright and how much energy is in the voice of a person that I know is gone. And it seems to me one of the challenging things about coming to terms with someone, with the loss of someone, is understanding something about that kind of continuing presence of that person, which in a way is what the book does. It makes a very present Carol, and many of us, you know, miss or are aware of the absent Carol. And to me, the front essay, which is about dealing with big loss, places you as a mind and a heart in the presence of that other character who stays present. And maybe I'm putting that extremely badly. That's why she does the CBC show and I don't.
No, actually, I think tunnel is actually a very good metaphor, because as I say, the book is more about life than death. But I wrote a preface
to your intro?
Exactly. I wrote a preface to the intro because the intro, this introductory essay, I called it Scrapbook of Carol, and it's too sad, and I don't think the book should begin with that. So I wrote a preface to lead into that, just to set it up. But I think tunnel is a good expression, because it is like a tunnel, and then you come up, and then for three-quarters, four-fifths of the rest of the book, you're in the light, and you're encountering this very alive person. And that's why, even in the preface, I say that therein lies joy and abundance. But it is like you're going in a tunnel first. You're right.
I think the tunnel, to me, the tunnel is what makes it possible to see how much brightness there is. I mean, Carol's a very bright, she's a bright light. And I was so struck by that when I heard her voice again. I didn't realize how much I missed the voice, too. But there's a lot of light in the voice. There's a lot of brightness and curiosity, and even the very last part of the interview that you played, which is a very difficult thing to know. Someone who is no longer here saying, it's just a breath, it's not that big. Or whatever, that something mm-hmm. like that, it's not that big. To move through the introductory essay and to know that you're going to take us through this, I think makes it more possible to feel the brightness in the presence of the second half. I'm glad you spilled your guts. Good for you. Are there questions from the floor, that the things that you'd like to ask about this book, or about Eleanor's incredible life as an interviewer and prober? Yes. I'm just going to repeat that, because sometimes it's a bit hard to hear around the room. The question is, how did you gain your skills as an interviewer, and how do you get people to spill their secrets? And that's asked by a writer.
In terms of, I think I've always, I was in high school what was described as a good listener. And
which is code for something?
Oh, no, it wasn't code like, oh, she has a good personality, which meant she really didn't look too good.
Yeah, that's right.
It wasn't code, no. It meant I was a good listener. No, all the magazines, of course, told girls you should be a good listener. I mean, mm-hmm. that was part of what your job. But I was genuine. I was a good listener. In fact, at one point, I remember somebody saying, "Oh, you should be
And I've been accused of being a kind of a shrink monkey because I could draw people out and ask them about their parents and things like that. But
and then run off with the goods.
But I think I have a much better job than a shrink monkey, because if you're a shrink, then they come back the next week and you hear the same story again, and they haven't even, you're lucky if they've moved a millimeter forward about it, you know, on anything. So no, I'm much luckier. But I think in terms of I am, and it's not that I'm self, any, it has nothing to do with narcissism. I'm as narcissistic as the next person, but it has to do with I'm just more interested in hearing somebody else's story than my own. So I am genuinely interested in hearing people's stories. But I think in terms of one way that I don't know if I get people to spill their guts exactly, but I win the confidence of the people I'm interviewing is because I have read their work, and not everyone in the media has the opportunity or the time or the persistence or whatever it is. So I've read the work, and I've spent quite a lot of time thinking about their work, and I just think people appreciate that, and it's not that they let their guard down, but they're just more engaged in the conversation because they feel that you're asking them something that's... And also, I do ask things that are related to the work one way or another. I mean, I
you're not prying.
Oh, I am prying, but I probably am. But it comes from the work. If they've written about family in their work, or if they've done some, you know, or something like that. I mean, yeah. It certainly is embedded in the writing.
Because the writing is what you're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The question is, what did Carol teach you about yourself or your own life?
That's a hard question. I would have to think about that. She, there was a something that Carol did within her family is people would, when you left someone after you saw them for a while, because they live in all different cities and things, they would say, give me some advice. They would ask for advice. So I tried that, you know, thinking I could get some advice or something. That didn't quite work. I think it's more that she was an inspiration, and I don't know that I've lived up to it. I know I haven't. I think she, particularly in her openness, and I mean, she was just astounding. I mean, I'm not idealizing her, putting her on a pedestal, but I mean, I saw her quite a lot when she was ill, and there would be people who would write to her because she had written articles in Canadian Living, and there were profiles of her in the New York Times magazine, and there would be people who would write to her who she didn't know, and or people that she barely knew or knew somewhat or knew a long time ago or whatever. She would respond to them. She would engage in a correspondence with them. I mean, even when she wasn't that well, when there was only a finite amount of energy and time. I mean, there really was this. So, I mean, I find that inspiring. I would like to live up to that kind of generosity and curiosity and continual engagement with the world. I don't think I don't see signs of it yet, but I would certainly like to do that.
When she says in that last clip that you played that conversation is such a critical part of her life, that's part of that, isn't it? That correspondence with people she doesn't even know, she's still engaging in conversation.
I interpret the conversation as being more with people that she knows and is interested in, and there I do feel part of that. I mean, there was back and forth. She enjoyed the conversations.
Other questions?
No.
I think we're looking for some indiscretion. Let me just reframe
Sure.
So that the people at the back can hear that. The observation is that we all want to race out and buy the books of the writers that we hear interviewed on Sunday afternoons, which is quite true. And the question is if Eleanor has interviewed people that... how did you ask that?
In a much more discreet... That I haven't gotten to know?
That you haven't... didn't feel connected with, didn't?
From time to time, are there ever bad interviews? From time to time, relatively rarely. I mean, generally speaking, I'm also lucky in my profession in that interviewing authors, or maybe people who are working with words, are likelier to be articulate, more so even than, let's say, I don't know, even filmmakers or visual artists or people where words isn't their medium. But there are some writers who I don't understand, I don't know why they would agree to be interviewed and then not be willing to really sort of answer questions or talk about their work. Occasionally that happens. Luckily, rarely, because both the producers and I put a lot of work into preparing for an interview, so you want to make sure you can get something out of it. Sometimes, usually I try to salvage something. I'm very tenacious. I just keep asking questions and sounding cheery when, you know, I'm just... all this stuff, you know, we can edit later, you know. Yeah, and try to at least get a reading or something in a short interview or, you know, get something from it. I remember one interview. This wasn't Graham Swift, who is I like his work a lot, and this wasn't that he was being unpleasant or truculent or whatever, but he simply... I mean, some writers, I guess, just aren't analytical about their own work or can't think about their own work in certain ways or talk about it. So his work, I mean, like Waterland, and his work is embedded in history. But when I asked him about that, he could only answer and say, well, everything is his history. A moment ago was history. I mean, it just, I mean, there's some people, the work is much more complex than the way that they're willing to talk about it. Mm. But that doesn't happen all that often. I mean, occasionally happens. You get somebody, you get somebody like Mordecai Richler, who just is drunk on stage and doesn't really want to answer very much, you know, but...
Okay, now's where we get some goods.
You got a very short interview there.
Yes. This is a question about power of selection, I think, and whether or not there's work that you don't like, genuinely don't like, and you end up interviewing the writer anyway, or do you just stay away from that stuff?
Well, I'm very fortunate that I, by and large, get to pick and choose who I talk to, and that's relatively rare in the media. I mean, there are just that many programs, and I get to choose the writers. So I choose people that I'm interested in or have heard positive things about or I've read earlier books and have enjoyed. What occasionally will happen is I've liked the earlier books and then the author isn't available and you have to wait for them to make themselves available, which is when they have their next book. And then that's not your favorite book, let's say. But I'm still interested in the work and I still value the work and you can still find something to talk about, even if that novel isn't your favorite novel.
So. Kind of talk about the earlier stuff.
We talk about the earlier stuff, but there's always something. There's ideas, or there's something in the novel you can address. So, but I'm lucky in that I would say that just everyone I've interviewed, I would sort of endorse their work and feel positive putting them forward and having you run out on Sunday evening looking for their books because I would think that their work is of value.
The questions. I saw a hand over here somewhere. Yes.
Is it the time subject coming back to the image of the tunnel? You gave us an impression of meaning that helps you, and as a friend, and as a person of incredible differentiation, and whatever she said and what she wrote and what she was. But then you have an interview with some writer. Is it ever that you know this work and it happens that it's not necessarily something that you are fascinated by? Is it sometimes that through the interview that he is making clear to you that this is much more special than you ever thought before?
That's an interesting question. So the question is basically, do you ever become excited or enlightened in the course of an interview or come to appreciate the work more than you did when you were just reading?
That does happen, yes. And some people, the opposite of what I was just describing with, let's say, someone like Graham Swift would be, some people are very, very good at talking about their work, and they illuminate aspects of the work that I wasn't necessarily attuned to. So, yes, that definitely can happen. And what also can happen is where you like the work, you're interested in the writer, but, I mean, somebody like Martin Amis, I remember the first time I interviewed him, he had a sort of bad boy reputation, and he looked a bit like Mick Jagger, and I didn't know what he was going to be like, and you know, he read about sort of rough things and all this stuff. I mean, I thought he was an interesting writer, but I just wasn't sure about him. I interviewed him. He sounds like George Steiner. I mean, he got a double first at Oxford. He's the most articulate, thoughtful person. So you can be surprised even just from the way that an author presents to you.
Mm-hmm. The observation is that the writers sometimes seem to be quite startled in interview or surprised and maybe surprised into another way of seeing by your questions, by the encounter with you as an interviewer. Do you get that sense?
Occasionally. I mean, I'd like to think that happens, but occasionally that will happen. And occasionally they'll remark and say that they hadn't thought about it that way or they hadn't made that connection. And usually they're open to that. Sometimes, I remember the first time I interviewed Doris Lessing, she was totally not open to any connections I was trying to make between her different books. And it was only
they're
much
totally
later.
Not connected.
Exactly, yeah, exactly, yeah. And luckily, the second time I interviewed her, which actually was the day that Carol died, I was in London, and fortunately for me, Margaret Drabble put in a good word so that Doris Lessing didn't eat me up on that day, because I think I would have burst into tears had she.
Yeah.
But she was much more open, and I don't know if anyone heard that interview. At one point her cat came over to me, and you could hear this on the radio. And said, "Oh, my cat likes you. That's very rare."
The secret lives, right?
Other questions? Yes.
There's a personal question.
That's fine.
The question is that Carol's observation in that last clip of tape is that she's not expecting something after this life. And so the question is, how are you in that?
Do I feel the same way in this life as it? Yes, I do. Yeah, I do. Oh, Carol was quite extreme in that she didn't want any funeral or monument or headstone or urn or ashes she didn't want anything like that. She was quite extreme about that.
How do you think she'd feel about a book?
A book? Oh, a book is a book.
Yeah.
I'm sorry? Oh, I think there was a memorial that was in Victoria, and there was a memorial service here in Winnipeg. Where people came and talked. Yeah, she was cremated, yeah. I think off Vancouver, off Victoria. I think, I'm not 100% sure.
Other questions? The question is, when a writer comes from another country or another language, do you have a translator or an interpreter?
No, I've done that for very short interviews, but for the kind of conversations that I like to have, I'm not comfortable going through an interpreter. It's unfortunately a limitation because I do these series in different countries, such as Argentina or Turkey or Central Europe, and so it does limit who I can speak to in those countries. It has to be people who have some grasp of English and relatively good grasp in order to discuss their work. But going through an interpreter is, first of all, I find it hard to do on radio. I don't think it works that well. You hear another voice. At a very elemental level, I don't know who to look at when I'm asking the question, because you're looking at the person and then the interpreter is translating and then the person is speaking and then the going back. I mean, it doesn't work.
Hard
I think
to choreograph that.
Yeah. With television, it's easier because you can have subtitles. I know with radio, occasionally you do that and you hear the person speaking and then the voice fades out and then you hear the interpreter's voice. I think that's okay for short clips or short bits, but for long conversations, it just doesn't work.
Well, it seems like a lot of information is conveyed actually by voice and cadence.
By voice and word choice and actual word choice, and interpreters, I mean, they have to take liberties. They're doing it instantaneously, and it's just doesn't work.
Yeah. Yes. You must write your questions out.
Yes, I work with a producer. We write out. I have lots and lots of questions, but I also listen to what people say and respond to what they say and don't necessarily follow the questions or in the order. But I always. I mean, I would certainly, if anyone asked me advice about how to do interview, I would say go in with a lot of questions.
It's kind of one of those tricks where. Sometimes you hear interviews that are so scripted that you just feel frustrated because it seems like an interviewer hasn't listened to anything.
So they've just gone down the list. Yeah.
Next.
That's bad.
That's not good. So it's a kind of a balancing act then between planning and then being present.
Well, you have to. I think of it as sort of like a roadmap, but you can take different routes. So you have a sense of where you want to go, but you don't have to go through each town the way you've laid it out. You can hop around depending where the person goes and have the agility to follow where they're going so that it sounds relatively smooth.
Thanks.
There's a woman. Yeah.
The question is about whether or not you interview, do you always interview in person, face-to-face, or do you sometimes interview from studio to studio or by phone? And what do you find the differences to be?
I do a lot of interviews not face-to-face. Initially, I used to be concerned about that. I prefer face-to-face, but I was concerned about it. I remember talking to a producer about it, and she said, well, when it's not face-to-face, you're getting exactly what the listener gets. You know, so you can't be distracted or seduced by body language or expression or anything. You're just hearing the voice and making a connection to the voice, and that's all that the listener is getting. So I'm comfortable doing both ways. The advantage of not face-to-face is that I can spread my papers out and I don't have to make eye contact and, you know, I can just throw things around. You know, I don't have to... but the advantage of face-to-face is, and there are some people and some interviews where I really feel it does make a difference. And I remember interviewing Robert Stone, who did speak very personally, and I felt I wouldn't have gotten that if it wasn't face-to-face. Another time, I remember the first time I interviewed Jamaica Kincaid, who I think is an extraordinary writer. Oof. And at one point, it was not face-to-face. And at one point, I asked her something, probably one of these personal-ish questions, and she said, oh, I can't tell you that over the phone, or something like that. And I thought, oh. You know, if only we were in the same room. Yeah. Most of the time, I like it if you can't tell. I mean, my goal would be that you wouldn't know the differences, so that even if it's not face-to-face, there can be a good connection.
That's a great question. Who are some authors that you would like to interview that you haven't yet?
There are a few. I almost got to, but missed it yet again. Philip Roth, V.S. Naipaul. They're not really nice people, but but I'm ready to go. I'm ready to brave it out. You know. I'd arranged to interview Philip Roth years and years ago, and he canceled. And then just this past summer. His latest book is coming out next month, and he has a Canadian publisher, and I was told he would do one Canadian interview, and I was all ready to do it, and then it, last minute that canceled. So, for a long time, I wanted to interview Joan Didion, and then I did get to interview her with Year of Magical Thinking.
That was a great interview, too.
Thank you. And so there are people I still would like to get to interview.
Is there anyone else you'd like to interview multiple times the way you did with Carol? Or do you have other writers in your stable that you've interviewed over and over again?
Well, I like to think of it as a stable.
That might have been an unfortunate choice of terms. playground.
In my drawing room.
Your drawing room.
In my, the salon of the radio. There are a few writers. It tends to be more Canadian writers. I've interviewed a number of times over the years. I mean, I have interviewed Michael Ondaatje and Margaret Atwood numbers of times over the years. I know them both personally, but not in the same way as with Carol. So I don't know whether, if I did put together a book of those interviews, it would be a different kind of book.
Right. This is a very particular set.
Yeah,
yes.
It's a one-off.
There's some sort of method to the madness of choosing the music, and that's a lot of M's.
Yeah. No. Thank you. I appreciate that. I work closely with a producer and an associate producer who I credit at the end of the show, Mary Stinson and Nancy McElveen, and we all really like music. They've had more formal training with it than I have, but we all like music. So we all have sort of an idea. It's probably similar to when somebody walks into, if you ever work in a bookstore, somebody walks into a bookstore and says, I'm interested in a book about something by somebody name begins with M. I mean, when we get together and talk about what music, and Nancy's the one sort of to go to the record library and dig things out, we'll say something like, it ends a little bit downbeat, but it's not really negative, and he's got quite a lot of energy, and it should be, you know, this type, and maybe a so-and-so, and maybe not, and not classical, but not too jazzy. I mean, it's like that, and we'll just go through a stack of CDs and choose something. But we all like enjoy it a lot, so it is an important component.
Yay! And it got recognized. Yay!
Other questions? I'll do my best to do a kind of
you can do just the last
paraphrase
bit would be
of that.
Okay.
The question is about whether or not there are writers who actually express themselves in writing and aren't comfortable in conversation. Although I did like your observations about the rhythms of conversation in interview, because there are necessary hesitations so that people can think and listeners can listen. Yeah, I agree with that too. But do you find there are some writers who just don't converse, that they really need to write in order to express themselves?
There are certainly that's true of some writers, and I think that some writers have expressed their unhappiness with the current fashion of book promotion, which is that the writer has to get out there and talk about their books, which not every writer really wants to do, and they've written the book and they've said what they've had to say in the book. So, I mean, I recognize that, and I respect that reluctance. It seems particularly, I find it harder to interview poets about their work, not always, but often poets, maybe because of the succinctness or the way of expressing themselves in their verse. If you ask questions about the poems, it's harder to sort of unpack them in the way that in prose it just seems like it lends itself more easily to questions and discussion.
Poems are hard to paraphrase.
And you don't want to paraphrase them because then they say, well, why did I make the poem if it can just be paraphrased? So it's a complicated process. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first time I interviewed Cynthia Ozick, and I'd read that when she had been interviewed by the Paris Review, they had sent the questions ahead of time, and then she typed back the answers, and she said she was more comfortable because it was in print rather than having to actually talk. But on the other hand, she's very, very good at talking. Nowadays, I know that there are online interviews. I mean, authors are interviewed by email, and they email back to the interviewer and that sort of thing. And I think that affects the conversation, and it's a different conversation.
Right.
But I think when Carol was talking about conversation, she wasn't talking explicitly about radio, formal interviews or interviews for broadcast. She was talking about the pleasures of talking to people, of that interaction with people. Mm-hmm.
One more question.
Just over there.
I can't see. Okay, yes. This question is about the relationship between bookmaking and the subject, family.
The question was, do I have to get permission from the family if I'm writing a book about Carol Shields? I certainly have to get permission from the family in order to quote from her letters and emails to me. It's a curious thing with the copyright. I physically own the letter, and I don't know how it works with email because it exists in whatever form you want, such that if I wanted to, let's say, auction off the letter, I can auction off the paper. But the content is owned by the person who writes the letter. It's a strange thing.
Fascinating.
So in order to quote from the content, I need permission from, in this case, the literary estate of Carol Shields, and it's administered by her husband, Don Shields. And that's a technical answer to the question. Certainly with this one, I wouldn't have written the book if there was anyone there who didn't want me to put it together. Don and was very supportive, very enthusiastic, and very happy to have it out there. As far as the actual interviews, some of the interviews I had already had. Interviews is a different category. Again, this is, again, the legal question. In all cases with all my books, I've always asked and received permission from the interviewee before publishing the interview or putting it in print. In my very first book, I asked one of the people who was in it was Margaret Atwood, and I asked again, as I was asking everyone, and she wrote back and said, yes, but you really don't need my permission because you own the interview because it was, or you or CBC owns the interview, even though it's being put into print. So I respect her legal knowledge and think she's probably right about this, but I nonetheless only feel comfortable if the person I've interviewed is okay with my publishing the interview in print.
Right. I would like to talk for about another hour, but I think we will not. What I would like to do is ask you to join me in thanking Eleanor Wachtel for a wonderful conversation and reading. And I'm happy to say that one of you will win a copy of Random Illuminations, and the rest of you will surge forward when the lights come up and buy your copy. And
mention Penn.
pin? Oh, and yes, and the proceeds. Thank you. She asked me one thing, and I forgot it. The the proceeds of the royalties will be donated to the Writers in Prison Committee of PEN Canada. So those of you who are aware of that, yes. And I would also mention that if you did not notice on your way in, we have a writer that we are advocating for at this year's festival. There's a petition in the lobby that you may please sign as you leave. And I'd also ask you to take a moment to fill out a very short survey. We're just this year beginning to collect some information from people who come to our programs to find out your satisfaction about it and get some suggestions from you about it. And what I forgot to mention last night is that one of you who decides at the end of the festival to go online and do our longer survey can win $200 gift certificate from EQ3, who provide the gorgeous furniture here. So I would encourage you to do that at the end of the festival to give us a little bit more global sense of your experience here at Thin Air. So I will do the draw right now. I think I'll do the draw right now. Yes, I will. Rush your ballots to the box. In a minute.
Are we signing books over there?
We can do it. Yes, I'll make sure that. Actually, I think there's a table.
Okay.